The Trial of Dr. William H. King. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation presents a play by Alan King based on the trial of an Ontario physician who, in the middle of the last century, was charged with the murder by poisoning of his young wife. The play is part of the series Famous Canadian Trials, produced in the Montreal studios of the CBC. The Trial of Dr. William H. King.
People noticed that I was not at my daughter's funeral. Perhaps they thought I was too ill to go. But I knew her husband would be there weeping over the grave, so it was safe to search their house. What I found there should help to hang that man.
That man was Dr. William Henry King, and his wife's funeral was held on November the 6th, 1858, in Brighton, Ontario. And while he was indeed weeping over the grave, his mother-in-law, Elizabeth Lawson, was searching his house, to good effect.
A picture of that girl, that's what I found, and love letters from her. Melinda Vandervoort, as flighty as her name. And to think my daughter was fool enough to introduce her husband to this hussy. Oh, I suppose I shouldn't speak like that about Annie, now that she's dead. But you told me yourself what happened. Less than 2 hours after she introduced them, she said this Melinda hussy was telling Annie how she felt about William.
He is my dream man, Mrs. King. I knew it the moment I saw his picture at your parents' house. Oh, I fell in love with him at once. Do you think, dear Mrs. King, that I might have a portrait of him?
I would have put her out of the house, but Annie gave her the likeness. And then she sent him hers.
The most precious thing, except the original, on earth.
And he only married to my daughter for 4 years. I told my husband it was his duty to speak to Simon Davidson, the coroner.
Only an inquest, Simon, can clear up the suspicions we have about our son-in-law. Now think of this. He meets this 20-year-old girl, Melinda. She says she's in love with him. They exchange portraits. And in 2 weeks, our daughter Annie has fallen ill. William treats her, says she has some disease of the womb. Later calls it cholera morbus and treats her for it. There's no improvement. So I insist that Dr. Fife be called in. Then she begins to get better. But at the beginning of November, she has violent pains again, and on November the 4th, she is dead. Don't you agree with me that West can discover the truth?
The coroner agreed and set the wheels in motion, and those wheels set Dr. King in motion.
To Cape Vincent in New York State. You can stay with my aunt there, Melinda, while I put an end to all this nonsense and the gossip connecting my good name with the death of my wife.
We, the coroner's jury, find the deceased, Sarah Ann King, came to her death by poisoning as the result of arsenic administered to her by her husband, William Henry King.
Sheriff, issue a warrant for King's arrest. If you can't lay your hands on him, I'll get him. He murdered my sister. And if you'll swear me in as a special constable, I'll get him for you.
And he did. Clinton Lawson, Annie King's brother, with a fine disregard for the niceties of international law, went down into New York State and brought back his brother-in-law at gunpoint. How he did it, he will describe at the trial held at Cobourg, Ontario, on April the 4th and 5th, 1859, before the Honorable Mr. Justice Burns, with Thomas Galt for the Crown and John Hilliard Cameron for the defense.
Mr. Galt.
May it please your lordship, gentlemen of the jury. In order to see the case I am about to present to you in its proper perspective, it will be necessary for me to describe to you from the beginning this marriage which has ended so terribly. This marriage between the man who stands accused before you, Dr. William Henry King, and Sarah Ann Lawson, who only a scant 4 years after that apparently happy event lay in her grave, the victim of a mysterious illness which up to this day has not been fully explained. The course of the marriage was from the start stormy. Within a year, the child had been born to this young man and his wife, and the wife had returned to the home of her parents, alleging that she had suffered maltreatment at his hands. But after some study of medicine in the United States, he returned to Ontario and settled down to practice medicine in the town of Brighton. There he was successful, not only in his practice, but in a reconciliation with his wife, who rejoined him. He built up a good reputation in his personal habits, and his practice throve. He was young, he was handsome, attractive to women, an attraction which he reciprocated. Gentlemen, it may have been a fatal attraction, for on September 21st of last year, He met a 20-year-old woman named Melinda Vandervoort, and from then on, a series of events took place which, in the contention of the Crown, culminated in the death by poison of Sarah Ann King.
Melinda Vandervoort appears in no way disturbed by Mr. Galt's involving her in the fatal sequence of events. She appears gay and pretty, and the onlookers can well understand her reputation as a flirt. Mr. Galt covers more history and then sets out the main points of the Crown's case.
I will prove, gentlemen of the jury, that Mrs. King was in good health up to October 4th of last year. But I will prove also that from that date until her death on November 3rd, she suffered violent pains and retching. I will prove that only poison can have caused her death, and I will adduce expert evidence as to the finding of 11 grains of arsenic in her stomach. I will suggest to you that the accused had a strong motive to murder his wife, a motive as old as the record of human history, an illicit attachment to another woman. I will present evidence that even before the coroner had concluded his inquest, the accused told his father-in-law that he expected to be apprehended on a charge of murder. You will hear that the accused had more than once prophesied his wife's death. Yet experts will swear to you that there was no trace of disease in her body. I will ask you to give particular attention to the fact that Dr. King administered all his wife's medicines. I will ask you also to consider that in connection with expert testimony, the symptoms of her illness were those of arsenical poisoning. And I will ask you to bear in mind that if the accused should claim that he administered arsenic by mistake, then the case before you will become narrowed down to one of intent. And it will then be your duty to weigh the evidence with meticulous care. Now, gentlemen of the jury, I will not take up any more of your time, but will proceed to call my first witness.
Simon Davidson, the coroner, and one of his jurors, followed by a conductor on the Grand Trunk Railway, assured the court that every precaution was taken in conveying the dead woman's stomach to Toronto for analysis. The analyst was Professor Henry Croft of the University of Toronto.
Upon examination, I found 11 grains of arsenic in the stomach.
Now, Professor Croft, could that arsenic have been put into the stomach after death?
It's a far-fetched suggestion, Mr. Cameron.
Far-fetched or not, could it have been possible?
There has already been evidence given as to the precautions taken in conveying the organs to me.
Professor, I am simply asking you to say, without comment, whether or not those 11 grains of arsenic could have been put into the stomach after death.
Yes, yes, they could.
Thank you, Professor Croft. Now, would you repeat, for the benefit of his lordship and the jury, what you told my learned friend about the condition of the stomach itself?
Well, I said...
I mean, was it inflamed?
Not seriously.
Very little, in fact?
Very little, yes.
Well, is that a condition that you would expect in the stomach of a person who had taken 11 grains of arsenic?
Well...
Would you not expect considerable inflammation?
Yes.
A very great deal more than you found?
Yes.
So much more, in fact, that the little you did find is negligible.
Yes.
Thank you, Professor Croft.
Have you any re-examination, Mr. Galt?
If it please your lordship, just one question. Professor Croft, on this matter of the introduction of arsenic after death, in your examination you stated that you found traces of arsenic in the liver.
That is correct.
Could that have been introduced after death?
To the liver? No. That would be quite impossible.
Thank you, Professor. That will be all.
But inflammation seems to be a matter of degree. Or is it time? The next three witnesses, all doctors, say that when they conducted the post-mortem, the lining of the stomach was inflamed. But they do not say greatly. And could the inflammation have subsided by the time the stomach reached the laboratory of the previous witness in Toronto? The doctors are the last of the Crown's expert witnesses and are followed by Mrs. Lawson, who goes over the history of the marriage and relates how her suspicions led her to demand an inquest and touches on some more pertinent details.
He always mixed his own medicines.
Do you mean for all his patients, Mrs. Lawson?
Oh, I couldn't swear to that. But I do know that the medicines he gave to my daughter, he mixed those right in his office.
Did you at any time discuss with the accused the effects of these medicines on your daughter?
Yes. I said they don't seem to be doing her any good. And he said it only seemed that way. He was a homeopathic doctor, you know. And he said he had to give her the medicine that would produce the same symptoms in a healthy body. I didn't quite understand the treatment, but he was so successful with his other patients that I supposed he knew what he was doing.
Mrs. Lawson, will you tell us what happened on November 3rd? That is the day before Mrs. King died.
Well, Annie went to sleep early. I was over at her house, and he said she'd gone to sleep, that she had never slept better. Of course, I was glad to hear that, because sometimes the pains have been terrible, and she'd spent some nights in agony instead of sleeping.
You did not actually see your daughter on the night of November 3rd?
Not after he told me she was asleep, no.
Did you see her the next morning, the morning of the day she died?
Yes. I went in with him to her bedroom. I thought she would be awake and perhaps feeling better after her long sleep. But she seemed to be still asleep. I was afraid. It seemed such a heavy sleep, like the sleep of death. I spoke to her. I tried to wake her and call her by name. She tried to open her dear eyes, but could not.
And shortly after that, your daughter died?
Yes. Yes, she was dead.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Lawson. That will be all I have to ask you.
And now to the witness stand comes the man without whom Dr. King might never have been available for trial. The brother of the dead woman, Clinton Lawson, who took the law into his own hands.
Oh, everything was quite legal, Mr. Galt. I was sworn in as a special constable, and I had a warrant for King's arrest. And being in the United States, of course, I took a U.S. Marshal with me when I went after him.
Did you know where King was?
Oh, yes, sir. I inquired at the local post office at Cape Vincent. And they told me that...
I object, my lord. What somebody told this witness is not evidence.
Objection sustained.
You must not tell us what anybody said, Mr. Lawson. As a result of inquiries that you made at the local post office, what did you do?
Well, I went, 6 or 8 miles into the country to the house of a Mr. Bate. Now, Mr. Gordon, the U.S. Marshal, was with me.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
Well, I hid, so King wouldn't see me. And Mr. Gordon went to the door to ask for him. Gordon, had not been in the house for 3 minutes when Dr. King jumped out of the window. Well, I ran after him, and he ran towards the woods. But as I was after him, quick, he turned and ran into a barn. Well, we went in and found him under the straw in a hog's nest.
And then what did you do?
Well, I told him he was under arrest and he'd better come home.
He accepted your authority and came.
Yes, sir.
Cross-examination, Mr. Cameron?
Yes, my lord. Now, Mr. Lawson, you agreed with my learned friend that Dr. King accepted your authority and came.
What?
Did you just stand there and say to him, I am a special constable, come with me, and he came?
Well, not exactly.
Well, you showed him your authority as a special constable.
Oh, yes, yes.
Did you use any other persuasion?
I don't understand.
Did you use anything but your badge and your warrant to persuade him to come with you?
Well, I...
Did you, Mr. Lawson?
I had a revolt.
And did you threaten him with...
I said he'd be shot if he ran. A lawyer told me that I had no right to
take... And so he came.
Well, I guess he did.
Willingly?
Oh, no, sir. No, sirree.
That'll be all, Mr. Lawson.
Now the Crown introduces evidence to show motive. And very pretty, lively motive it is, too, in the person of Melinda Vandervoort.
Did you or did you not send to Dr. King this picture that I now show you, this likeness of yourself?
Yes, I sent it,
and did you or did you not send this letter to the prisoner?
Yes, I did.
One moment, please. My lord, I will request that this witness now be asked to step down. I must read this letter, and one in reply. But I do not wish to do so while she's in the witness box.
Very well. You will step down, witness.
Thank you, my lord. Now, my lord, and gentlemen of the jury, the first letter is one from the prisoner to Miss Vandervoort, and it reads as follows. Sweet little lump of good nature, I long looked with prudent anxiety for the arrival of the object of my thoughts, but began to despair. Still, I had too much perseverance to give up. I walked to the post office this morning and found the most precious thing except the original on earth. Better
and
to me
so
than
on,
all California,
in the same vein. With one paragraph, however, which must surely have caught the attention of the jury.
It's a perfect infatuation for me. Can you keep from sacrificing yourself upon the hymeneal altar for the next year? I wish so.
The letter is unsigned, but there is no doubt about its authorship, and the reply to it is acknowledged by the present witness.
One smile only from your countenance can inspire a depth of veneration in my bosom never felt by me for any other individual. Well now, Doctor, don't you consider it very wrong for me to correspond with you? I'm afraid, if known, it would destroy Annie's happiness. And, for instance, if I was in her position, I would much rather be in my grave than suffer the idea of your intimacy with another. Though perhaps you express some of your ideas to me for pastime, if so, I hope you'll not continue them, for I am easily flattered and it may prove to me something very serious. I'm very lonely. My sister has not returned yet. I am pretty well and hope you enjoy the same blessing. Please answer if you deem me worthy. I hope you will not criticize your wavering. Then there's the letter L followed by a dash, and the letter is signed Van.
And the witness returns to the box for cross-examination.
Now, Miss Vandervoort, you say you did send your picture to Dr. King?
Well, yes, sir, I did. Mrs. King asked me to.
His wife asked you to send it?
To her, directed to him.
You mean that Mrs. King asked you to send your picture to her so that she could give it to her husband? And did she also ask you to write to him?
Well, no, but when I got the letter from him, I thought it was written for amusement.
What?
And I sent him the letter in answer. For amusement.
Oh, for amusement.
She must have conveyed her amusement to the prisoner, judging by the observation of the reporter for the Toronto Globe.
While the letters were being read, the prisoner showed no sensibility, but rather seemed to share in the amusement which could not be repressed.
Indeed, according to Melinda, there was nothing serious between her and Dr. King.
I never had any improper intercourse with Dr. King.
But with the opening of the defense, frivolity was abandoned.
You are Dr. Charles J. Hempel of Philadelphia.
Yes, sir.
Would you tell his lordship, Doctor? Would you tell his lordship and the jury something of your occupation and qualifications?
I am a professor of materia medica at the Homeopathic College in Philadelphia.
That's the college at which Dr. King studied?
That's right, sir.
Now, Doctor, you've heard it given in evidence here that 11 grains of arsenic were found in the stomach of the deceased.
That's right, sir.
And that the stomach showed signs of only slight inflammation.
Yes.
Would you care to comment on that, Doctor?
In my opinion, sir, those two facts are not consistent. The presence of 11 grains of arsenic should have produced far greater signs of inflammation.
Now, turning to the administration of arsenic, Doctor, can you tell us whether or not it is ever prescribed for the treatment of disease?
Oh, for several diseases, yes. In small quantities.
I see. Is cholera morbus included among those diseases, Doctor?
Yes, arsenic's often used for the treatment of that disease.
Now, what are the dangers in taking arsenic?
Well, there's no danger from taking small doses. Arsenic, you see, is not a cumulative poison. Now, by that I mean small doses do not accumulate into a large quantity and cause fatal results. To cause death, arsenic must be introduced in a large dose.
Would you care to express an opinion, Dr. Hempel, as to the possible cause of death in the case of Mrs. King?
Well, it's difficult to say at this stage. But from what I've heard here in court and from what I've read in the medical reports, it seems to me that the post-mortem examination was not sufficiently thorough to enable anyone to make an exact diagnosis. Mrs. King may, perhaps, have died of nervous exhaustion.
You consider that a possibility?
It is a possibility, yes. And then I have heard it given in evidence that she fell from a buggy. Now, such a fall would be likely to aggravate any malady which she had at the time.
But there is nothing really conclusive about Dr. Hempel's evidence. A professor of chemistry and toxicology from the same college, Dr. Flanders, proves to be unpopular with the spectators.
To my mind, the cause of Mrs. King's death is very obscure. The most satisfactory reason for it that I can think of is the fall from the buggy. As far as the presence of arsenic in the body is concerned, I believe that was introduced after Mrs. King's death.
Order in court. Dr. Flanders, do you set your opinion against that of Dr. Croft,
A man well known even in your country.
Well, Professor Croft is not a practicing physician. I did not understand him to say he had ever examined any cases of arsenical poisoning.
Is it not true that you yourself have not seen any cases of arsenical poisoning in human beings, only in cats and dogs?
That is so, sir.
Dr. Flanders is followed by Dr. Thomas Nickel of Simcoe, Ontario, who knew Dr. King and thought well of him, and who also conducted an experiment with arsenic on himself.
It was in 1855. For 21 days, I took 3 doses of arsenic per day of 1/3 of a grain per day, amounting to 7.5 grains in all. On the 8th day, I noticed certain symptoms similar to the ones attributed to the deceased Mrs. King.
And were you able to draw any conclusion from your experiment, Doctor?
Chiefly, sir, that arsenic is a cumulative poison, contrary to the opinion of many and to the opinions which have been expressed in this court.
If, then, it had been possible to examine the contents of your stomach after those 8 days, what do you believe would have been found there?
Well, the sum of the doses of arsenic which I had taken. In other words, 7.5 grains.
But this is merely opinion set against opinion, and provides one more point for the jury to consider. There are only 2 more witnesses, and the defense is concluded, all but Mr. Cameron's address to the jury, in the opening of which he strongly warns them against prejudice.
Now, gentlemen, I know that there have been, perhaps from prejudice, perhaps from the natural irritation which must have arisen in the minds of the relatives of the accused, I know that there have been spread through that part of the country from which the prisoner has come statements both prejudicial and wrong. I know that there have been publications in a newspaper of that locality which must have tended strongly to prejudice the prisoner in the minds of the people of the surrounding country, and tended greatly to prevent that kind of fair play that every man is entitled to who trusts himself to God and his country.
Mr. Cameron stresses and re-stresses the matter of giving the prisoner fair play, not only to the extent of resisting prejudice, but of overlooking foolishness.
Gentlemen, men are often foolish, and the prisoner at the bar has acted foolishly. Now, what does press against him is the fact of the letters which have been read to you having been found in the possession of the prisoner. Now, we can scarcely understand how the parents of that young girl allowed her to be taken away to a foreign country at the dead of night by a man who was to them a perfect stranger. Now, the only thing which can be said is that the prisoner did not dishonor the girl, because we have the fact proved that no intimacy took place. We have also proved that these two were only acquainted a little more than 3 weeks before the death of the prisoner's wife, and yet his supposed affection for this young woman is assigned as the reason which induced him to get rid of his wife.
But Mr. Galt, for the prosecution, considered that some of Dr. King's actions were much more than foolish.
All that had happened was that an inquest had been ordered. No accusations had been made. Why, therefore, did the prisoner abscond when he heard of the inquest? If he were innocent, why did he not remain so that he could say to the world, "You have conducted your inquest and there is no evidence of foul play"? I say to you, gentlemen of the jury, that he knew what the results of the inquest would be and fled in terror. As for the suggestion that someone put arsenic into the body of the deceased after her death, do you believe that anyone would have done such a diabolic act just to incriminate Dr. King? But even if you did believe such a thing, you cannot believe that arsenic was put into the liver, because you have heard sworn expert testimony to the effect that such a thing is impossible. Now, the defense has tried to excuse certain actions of the prisoner as being foolish. But I say to you now that all his actions, from start to finish, are completely consistent with guilt. And I submit to you that you cannot reasonably excuse him from the guilt of his wife's death.
His lordship summed up fairly and suggested to the jury that in their deliberations they answer 3 questions.
The first, what was the primary cause of death? Second, had the stomach been tampered with before Professor Croft's examination? And third, why did the prisoner take flight on 2 occasions? I must emphasize, however, that if you find his flight the action of a guilty man, it cannot alone be considered evidence of guilt. An innocent man may run away because of momentary fright or confusion. The flight of the prisoner, therefore, can only be considered in conjunction with all the other evidence you have heard. In conclusion,
having regard to what has been said about prejudice. I say to you now that the accused must not be convicted on mere suspicion, however suspicious his actions. You must be convinced of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. You must not raise fanciful doubts to bring about his acquittal.
But perhaps the jury did have some fanciful doubts, for they brought in a verdict rather strange in a case where if the accused was guilty, he must have deliberately planned his wife's death by poison.
We find the prisoner guilty with a strong recommendation to mercy.
4 days later, Mr. Justice Burns passed sentence after inquiring if Dr. King had anything to say.
Yes, my lord. I have this much to say, that upon my most solemn oath, I am not guilty of the charge laid against me. I have no doubt of this. My conscience is perfectly clear on this point.
I must say the facts carried conviction to my own mind, and I entirely concur with the verdict. I cannot see that yours is a case in which a recommendation to mercy is justifiable.
And it seems that the public generally concurred in the verdict, for none of the petitions launched in the doctor's favor met with enough support to be presented. And the public apparently were quite justified, for on May the 15th, 1859, 3 weeks before the date set for his execution, Dr. King confessed. But in doing so, he couldn't help laying much of the blame on someone else's shoulders.
I've been led astray by women. Women have been my ruin. I'm not the first one to be led astray by them. Women are costly things. They cost me too much. My action was caused by my ardent passion of love for the opposite sex.
But in one respect, Dr. King confounded the expert medical witnesses for the Crown. The cause of death, said Professor Croft and the others, was poisoning by arsenic. But Dr. King, in the shadow of his own death, would not have it.
The whole scientific world is deceived in reference to the cause of death. If this goes on record as a case of arsenical poisoning, it will be a most lamentable mistake. Arsenic is a cumulative poison. I therefore assert most positively that the 11 grains of arsenic found in Mrs. King's stomach accumulated there from a repetition of small doses, not larger than those laid down in the pharmacopoeias.
Certainly, Professor Croft had said that the arsenic he found had caused hardly any inflammation. What then was the cause of death?
I had purchased a half-ounce phial containing 1 dram of chloroform and gave it her early on the morning of the day she died, whereupon she sank into unconsciousness. The real cause of death was chloroform.
And who should know better than the man who admitted he had killed her? It made the evidence on which he had been convicted false, but nobody considered it cause for staying the hand of the executioner. The trial of Dr. William H. King was produced in Montreal by Rupert Kaplan as part of the series Famous Canadian Trials. Script by Alan King, based on research by R.S. Lambert. Leading roles were played by Henry Ramey, Albert Miller, Eileen Clifford, Paul Hecht, Walter Massey, Philip Nielsen, Howard Rishpan, Gordon Atkinson, Gerald Rowan, Joan Blackman, and George Alexander. The program was presented by this station through the facilities of the International Service of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.